after death, and we're going to think about also what's being said today about this earth and what's going to happen to it and some of the false teachings around that, and also some things related to like the new movie coming out, Left Behind, and premillennialism. And anytime you discuss those things, there is a lot of confusion because there's so much confusion set in the world. So I'm starting out tonight just looking at the terms and trying to define some terms. And so we're just going to go through a long list of biblical terms and then a list of religious terms and try to understand that. I'm also going to do something a little different tonight in that I'm going to ask at the end of the lesson, or maybe halfway through, and then secondly at the end, if you have any questions, and if I can clarify these terms, I'll try to do that. Or you can, as we do on question and answer night, you can send me a text at my phone number, and I'll try to answer it by that, either with you, you can meet me afterwards, or I will try to, if I get it, I'll try to answer it while I'm still here. So let's think a little bit about understanding end of time terms. First of all, some biblical terms and trying to understand what these mean. The first term I want you to know or understand is the term eschatology. And that's a term that is often used to define what we're talking about or the study of end of time things. And so if you hear this term, I probably won't use it very much, but if you hear it, it refers to the study of last things. And this is, comes from the Greek word eschatos. And you can look to John chapter 6. It's found a lot of times in the Bible. But in chapter 6, beginning at verse 44, you'll notice that it's found there. No one can come to me unless the Father who sent me draws him, and I will raise him up on the last, that's the term, day. I'll raise him up on the last day. In verse 54, it's found as well. Whoever feeds on me, my flesh, and drinks my blood has eternal life, and I will raise him up on the last day. And so eschatology is simply the study of the last day, or the last days, as you might think. John 12:48 has that as well. The next term is last days, that coming from that word eschatos. But we think about this, and people say the last days a lot. And basically in the New Testament, and all these are biblical terms that I'm trying to define, in the Bible, the term last days designates the last age of this world. All right, this is very important. Acts 2:17, he quotes from the prophet Joel, and where Joel prophesied that God would pour out his spirit upon man in the last days. And Peter says that is fulfilled here on Pentecost. In 2 Timothy chapter 3, verse 1, Paul writes about this concept as well. And he says in verse 1, but understand this, that in the last days there will come times of difficulty. And then he talks about these times of difficulty, and these are things that were happening then and have happened. And Paul is saying that that's what's going to happen during this time. Look to Hebrews chapter 1, verse 2, maybe the most important passage along this line. Long ago, at many times and in many ways, the man and I were talking this past week or two about growing up, you would always hear that divers term from the King James. And as a kid, I always pictured divers diving in the ocean, and that really has nothing to do with that. And I thought maybe I don't quote it enough because I don't know if our people are hearing Hebrews 1:1 enough. Maybe it's just not as memorable as it was in the King James in divers ways and as the verse went. But notice this is a very important verse. The ESV says, long ago, at many times and in many ways, God spoke to our fathers by the prophets. But in these last days, he has spoken to us by his Son, whom he appointed the heir of all things. Notice that this defines for us what the last days are. They are the last age. So if I were to draw that on a graph, it's from the time of Jesus to the return of Jesus, though this is the last age. In other words, there's no more age to follow this age. This world is going to be destroyed. 2 Peter 3:3 speaks of that concept, that this world is going to be destroyed after these last days. Boy, that's a big one. If people could understand that, it would help. The third one. What is death? Death is really more complicated than you might think, because death involves not just a physical definition, but in the Bible, it involves a spiritual definition as well. Because death involves the separation, in a spiritual sense, a separation from man, from God. And death entered into this world because Adam and Eve sinned. And everybody must pay the price of death. And in Revelation, it talks about the second death, where we're cast away into hell. The wicked are cast into hell, which is the second death, Revelation 20. And the concept there is, it's the ultimate separation from God. But if we like to define, the easiest way to define death, I think, is it is a termination of physical life, the separation of the soul and the body. James 2:26, faith without works is dead, so the spirit without the body is dead. So if you reverse that, when the spirit leaves the body, then that is when death takes place. Genesis 35 speaks of Rachel, I believe, and her soul was leaving her because she died. In 2 Peter 1:14, Peter refers to his tabernacle and the putting off of this outward tabernacle, this outward body, and the spirit going on to God. In 1 Corinthians 15, certainly talks about the resurrection and about how death is our enemy, and it's directly connected with sin. We're living in a time, because of our medical society, because of the technology in our medical community, where defining death is not always as simple as it used to be. And there can be a lot of issues with that, and I would certainly encourage you to make sure you have some things in place regarding your desires and regarding what you want to be done to you in terms of life support measures and things like that. Because we have a lot of issues around this topic that we didn't used to have. But death is when our physical life ends and there's a separation of the soul and the body. Heaven is the place where God dwells in the ultimate glorious abode of the righteous. In John 14:1-6, Jesus says, "Let not your heart be troubled. You believe in God, believe also in me. In my Father's house are many rooms. If it were not so, I would have told you that I go to prepare a place for you. And if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come again and I will take you to myself, that where I am, you may be also. And you know the way to where I am going." And Thomas said to him, "Lord, we do not know where you're going. How can we know the way?" And that's when Jesus says that famous statement that he is the way, the truth, and the life. The Bible often speaks or spoke, especially in the Jewish culture, and then Paul does this in 2 Corinthians 12. He talks about three levels of heaven. There's the heavens that we see, the where the birds fly, and the clouds. Then there's the second heavens, which is the stars and sun and moon. And then there's the third heaven in Jewish thought, where God dwells. All right, and so the heavens declare the glory of God. That when we look up and see the stars and we see the solar system, that shows us the awesomeness of God. But heaven is the throne of God. In other words, that's where God dwells. And it's not a geographical place, but it is a spiritual dwelling place. And that's where Christ has returned to. And that's the ultimate glorious abode of the righteous, the home of the soul that he has gone to prepare for us. We're going to talk next Sunday morning about what's heaven like. Paradise is equated in many ways with heaven. And I know if you've been in the church a long time, you might have heard about the Hadean realm and things like that. To me, I think it's easiest to look at this as paradise today basically is synonymous in many ways with where God dwells, with heaven. In Luke 23, verse 43,
the Bible speaks of Jesus being on the cross and telling that thief on the cross, "Today you will be with me in paradise." And then in 2 Corinthians, look to that passage with me, 2 Corinthians 12. And once again, this is definition, so I can't get into all these. I just want to try to give you a simple definition so that when we study these things, you'll have a concept. We're going to look at a lot of these things in more detail later on. In 2 Corinthians 12, I must go on, verse 1, "I must go on boasting, though there is nothing to be gained but by it. I will go on to visions and revelations of the Lord, for I know a man, probably himself, in Christ, who 14 years ago was caught up to the third heaven. Whether in the body or out of the body, I do not know. God knows. And I know that this man was caught up into paradise. Whether in the body or out of the body, I do not know. God knows." Notice, from my point, Paul says he went to the third heaven, which is where God dwells. And he says he was caught up into paradise in the next verse. So it seems to me that Paul viewed heaven and paradise as the same place in this context. In Revelation 2:7, Jesus promised to one of the seven churches the opportunity to be in paradise with him if they would be faithful. Some other terms: hell is the final abode of the unrighteous dead, wherein the ungodly will suffer punishment. The Bible speaks more about hell than it does heaven. Jesus spoke more about hell. Jesus would say, for example, in Mark 9:43-48, that it's where the worm does not die and the fire is not quenched. He talked about it being a place of outer darkness, a place of weeping and gnashing of teeth. Jesus told us that we should cut off our hands, cut off our feet. We should do whatever necessary. And of course, he's probably talking in a way that is exaggerated, what we call hyperbole. But he is still making the serious point that we should avoid everything going to hell. Let me say a couple things about hell that we need to mention. Hell is from the Greek word Gehenna. You probably heard that. The Greek word Gehenna, which was a physical valley outside of Jerusalem that had been used for pagan worship to offer even babies unto the pagan god Molech. And because the Jewish people were so repulsed by that location, they turned it into a trash heap and a place where paupers and other poor people were buried or their bodies were thrown to. So it was where fire was constantly going, where worms were there eating the decaying matter. And Jesus says, when he's trying to describe what hell spiritually is like, he says, "Look at that trash dump over there that has decaying matter, decaying bodies, and where fires are constantly going." And that's what hell's going to be. It's going to be a place like that, but greater than that. The next term is Hades. Hades is used, and if you're using the King James, there was some confusion because sometimes Hades was translated as hell in the King James, but I think it's better to translate it as Hades as it is in most of the newer versions. And Hades is actually a term used a lot in the Old Testament as well. Or in the Old Testament, it is Sheol. It is Sheol. And it is the realm of the departed spirits. All right, it's the realm of departed spirits. In the Old Testament, it's very shadowy, and they don't really know a lot about it. It's the grave. But in the New Testament, it is spoken of as the place in Luke 16 where the rich man goes, and he is in torment in Hades. And in Revelation chapter 1, verse 18, Jesus is said to have the keys of death and Hades. And then in chapter 20 of the book of Revelation, chapter 20, verses 13 and 14, "And the sea gave up the dead who were in them. Death and Hades gave up the dead who were in them. And they were judged, each one of them, according to what they had done. Then death and Hades were thrown in the lake of fire." That is the second death, the lake of fire. "If anyone's name was not found written in the book of life, he was thrown in the lake of fire." Hades can be somewhat confusing, and we'll talk more about that later, but let's just kind of define it now as the realm of departed spirits. Eternal means eternal. It means forever. It means everlasting. Key verse on this is Matthew chapter 25, verse 46. In recent years, there has been those who have tried to say, even those amongst us who have taught for years, for example, Jimmy Allen, who taught a lot about hell, have in recent years tried to say that heaven is eternal, but hell is not. And really, it's kind of a modified version of the Jehovah's Witness belief that hell is more of an annihilation, that you go out of existence. And that would be nice to believe, but the problem with that is, in Matthew 25, verse 46, these will go away into eternal punishment, and the righteous into eternal life. Now, it's the same Greek word used to modify punishment as it is to modify life. In other words, Jesus clearly says that there is eternal, everlasting, never-ending punishment, just as there is eternal, everlasting, never-ending life or salvation. And the Bible speaks of this in other places. For example, Revelation 20 and 2 Thessalonians 1:9 would be some examples of that. The next term, the day of the Lord. The day of the Lord is a time when God reveals His sovereignty over human affairs and human powers. This is a phrase that's used a lot in the prophets. And this phrase is used for within time and the final judgment. See, here's a big mistake a lot of people make. They go back and they read books like Malachi, Isaiah, Ezekiel, that have Zephaniah, that have this term, Amos, have this term in them a lot, the day of the Lord. And they automatically read that, and we can do this from time to time, they automatically read that and they assume it's a prophecy about the final day of the Lord. But that's often a very big jump that gets you into a lot of interpretive problems with the Bible. Because the prophets were often, and many times they speak of this, they talk about the days of the Lord that have been fulfilled. They're talking about judgments where God has come in judgment upon a physical nation, maybe on Israel, maybe on Judah, maybe upon Babylon, Egypt. He often does that in the prophets. Now, there's also a futuristic component of the day of the Lord where the prophets were looking forward to the time when God would set everything right at the ultimate day of the Lord. So the prophets do speak of that. In the New Testament, the writers use the term to refer to the final victory of Christ. The final victory of Christ. Look at chapter 5, verse 5. Chapter 5, verse 5 of 1 Corinthians. You are to deliver this man to Satan for the destruction of the flesh, so that his spirit may be saved, here's our phrase, in the day of the Lord. So he's talking about this final day. Look at 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, verse 2. 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, verse 2. For you yourselves are fully aware that the day of the Lord will come like a thief in the night. And so he talks about this idea in 2 Peter 3:10. It talks about it as well. Let me finish these terms, and I have one question I want to address about paradise and Hades too in a moment. But let me continue on and get through these biblical terms because they're all kind of relating. The next term is parousia. And you may not have heard of that one a lot because it's a Greek word, but I didn't know what English word to use. Necessarily, but it's the term for the coming of the Lord and when Jesus returns. And this is used a lot, and it refers to the time when Jesus is going to return. And the New Testament uses this term a lot, and typically it's translated as the Lord's coming or something to do with His coming. But the New Testament anticipated this arrival, this coming of Jesus. In fact, the Thessalonian church had anticipated this coming and thought it was so soon that many of them had quit work and they had become lazy and were busybodies. They were just sitting around waiting for Jesus to arrive. In fact, they were so concerned that they thought that their friends who had died were even going to miss out on the parousia, the coming of the Lord. And so a parousia in Greek literature and in Greek culture involved a key general or emperor coming to your town. And it's kind of like, you know, maybe with what's going on in our world today with politicians. If there's some big politician come and they make sure that they're all ready. Kind of like, I know Clinton came to Paducah and they were telling me all the things they had to do. The Secret Service the day before were here, like 8 guys going through everything, making sure they had a plan of how they were going to get him in and where they were going to park the vehicle and then where he was going to leave. And they had all this safety and security issues covered because there was an ex-president coming. And, well, that's the term is also used a lot for just talking about other people coming. But when we talk about the Lord coming, it takes on a special significance of when is Jesus coming and this anticipation for it. The next term is judgment, the final act of human history where God intervenes between bringing this world to an end and judging humans. And so the parousia, the coming of the Lord, is then followed with the judgment, the great white throne judgment. And the Bible speaks a lot of that. Kenneth's passage that he read from John 5, 22 through 30 speaks of that. 2 Corinthians 5, 10 says that we must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ to receive what we've done in the body according to what we have done, whether good or bad. And then the Antichrist. Oh boy, we hear a lot about that. And I'm sure I probably should just left this one off because I won't say enough to make to whet your appetite fully, to fulfill you. But the Antichrist is only used 5 times in the New Testament. Only used 5 times. It's found none in the book of Revelation. Think about that. People want to say, oh, the Antichrist is going to come back. And, you know, in this premillennialism, the Antichrist comes back, or the Antichrist comes, and he's a force that leads the armies of wickedness against Christ. And that's all coming from Revelation. Yet, the Antichrist is never found in Revelation. It's spoken of in the epistles of John. The epistles of John, 1 John 2 and 4 and 2 John 7. And basically, John uses it, and maybe he made up the word. It just simply means, and we still use this, anti is the term, right? It means someone who is opposed or against Christ. And in John's concept, it was primarily directed toward false teachers who were opposed to Christ and against His teaching and His Word. And so the Antichrist in John's letters is not one specific person, but actually is a plurality of people. And actually is the forces of those who are working against Christ. And I think that's a very important definition to know, though. All right, let me stop before I look at a few religious terms. And I had one question about the issue of Hades and paradise. And I'll try to briefly answer that because I may do a sermon on that later to clarify it, but I'll try at this point to address it. The traditional belief has been that you have the Hadean realm. A lot of this comes from Luke 16. And you have that Hadean realm divided into Tartarus, torments, is often called, where the rich man went, and paradise, Abraham's bosom, where Lot went. And that there's a great gulf between them, so that there cannot be a passage back between, and that's the Hadean realm, and when you die, you go to Hadean realm to await a judgment. And that that paradise, or that Hadean realm, is not in heaven. It's separate from the glorified state of heaven. And that may be accurate. That may be true. That's certainly worth a lot of study. But I have, over the years, taught and believed that it makes more sense to believe that after the cross, that paradise, or what the Bible speaks of as paradise, is with Jesus. All right? Because that seems to be the clear teaching. That's the simple teaching. Paul says to be absent from the body is to be at home with the Lord in 2 Corinthians 5. Paul speaks in 2 Corinthians 12 there about when he was called up into the third heaven where God dwells, that he was in paradise. All right? There are several other passages where it speaks of paradise, where departed saints, being with Jesus. Right? Paul says, I have a desire to depart and go to paradise. No, that's not what he says, does it? He says, I have a desire in Philippians chapter 1 to depart and be with Christ. He wanted to go be with Jesus. So I believe that when a saint, a Christian dies, they go be with Jesus. All right? That's the simplest passage or simplest teaching, I believe. And it seems to me then that Jesus is at the right hand of the Father. He's where God is, which is heaven. So therefore it seems that paradise, or as I was saying, really is equivalent to what the Bible also calls heaven. So my view would be that paradise is with Jesus in heaven, and then after the judgment, there will yet be a glorified state of heaven because we'll have a resurrected body and we'll enter into that eternal or glorified state of heaven with our new body. But still at this point, I think saints go be with Jesus. I think that is spoken of in Revelation chapter 6 when the saints are crying out under the altar, how much longer, O Lord, before you avenge our blood upon the earth? Those saints are with Jesus, it seems. I think 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, he'll bring with him those who sleep in Jesus. He's going to bring all those saints with him, and they're going to rise first. 1 Thessalonians chapter 4. So that would be my answer on that. And once again, I hope to study that more in a separate lesson later on. But I hope that addressed it now. If you have a question on that, though, you can go ahead and send it to me on text, or I'll try to stop in a minute if I have time at the end. Some religious terms. All right, I want to try to clarify this. I had a man asking me about this morning when he saw that we were talking about this. We need to understand these terms. I do not believe premillennialism, but I do think we need to understand it, especially with all that's been said in our world. Millennial refers to 1,000 years, right? So millennialism involves some idea about the thousand-year reign of Jesus. And this is spoken of in Revelation chapter 20, the reigning of Jesus. And here's the basic belief, and we're trying to just define this, is premillennialism believes before, all right? This is pretty, if you focus on the prefix, you can figure this out, because we're going to look at pre, ah, and post. And pre believes that Jesus comes before the millennial reign, and then he reigns on earth for 1,000 years. He reigns on earth 1,000 years. At the end of that 1,000 years, the wicked are resurrected, and they go to hell. There's the judgment. They go to hell, and the righteous go to heaven, and the earth is then destroyed. This is the predominant belief of evangelical Christians today. All right, it's the predominant belief of evangelical Christians. It's really only about 100 years in popularity. It dates back to a man named Darby, who really popularized this belief. And it involves the tribulation, which is a 7-year period of tribulation before Jesus returns. And it involves the Antichrist and all that is often put forward in that. And so the problem with this is that it makes the church an afterthought, because God was not able to set up his kingdom when Jesus came because the Jews rejected him. So he set up the church as an afterthought. and he will come again one day to set up his kingdom. I have a sermon I preached here before called Five Denials of Premillennialism. And if you have more interest, I can get that to you. The next one is, because we're trying to define it, I'm going to move pretty quickly. Amillennialism. And you would, most of us would fall in this category. And we don't necessarily know that, but this is about where we'd fall. In the sense that we don't often talk about being amillennialist. But all means not millennial, right? So it's really kind of not the best term, because we do believe in a millennial reign, but we don't believe that it's a physical reign here on this earth. But we believe that Revelation 20 was talking about spiritual or figurative things, and that Christians are reigning now with the Lord, and the consummation is not yet, and that Christ will return, and when Christ returns, the church now is his kingdom on earth. Church is his kingdom on earth. And Christ will return. And when he returns, there will not be a reign upon this earth, but rather there will be a general resurrection and judgment, and the world will be destroyed. Postmillennialism is not very popular today. Postmillennialism believes that the world will become better and better, and the gospel will increase and advance, and there will be a gradual Christianization of the world. And it doesn't believe necessarily in a that like Jesus lives here, but what it's saying is the overall nations are converted to Christ for a period of about 1,000 years of complete peace and unity upon this world, brought about by the gospel. Let me briefly illustrate that. Postmillennialism says things are going from worse to better and better. So the more the Campbell was a postmillennialist. That was his journal's name, the Millennial Harbinger, Alexander Campbell. And many of the Restoration leaders, Barton W. Stone, some of them had a lot of postmillennial beliefs. It was in the early 1800s, and there was a lot of belief that we were going to attain higher and higher status as humans, and there was a lot of belief in the gospel, that the gospel would convert the nations, and that the nations would be surrendered to Christ, and that there would be peace and unity upon this earth. And this is the big idea of restorationism. People would give up their creeds and their doctrines, and they would come into unity of the gospel, and the gospel would spread throughout the whole world. That's postmillennialism. And World War I, World War II, Civil War really shattered that idea. And now people turn to premillennialism, which is things go from being better to worse and worse and worse until Jesus comes back and then reigns on earth for 1,000 years. All right, tribulation. Or the rapture is the belief that there will be a secret snatching away of Christians before the millennial reign. So the rapture is this idea that, you know, you're riding in your car and boom, the car's no longer driven because you've been raptured away. The word rapture is not found in the New Testament. It comes from a Latin word of the translation of 1 Thessalonians 4 and verse 17. And it's not a biblical term per se, though the Bible does refer in what some might think of as a rapture. But the doctrine of rapture is not taught in the Bible. The term tribulation is a, once again, religious term outside the Bible. And it's a time of intense wrath or persecution on the earth before the return of Christ. So those who would believe in a tribulation typically put it at 7 years. They get that from Daniel. And they see it as a time of great tribulation on earth. Now, tribulation people, which I'm not one, but tribulation people are divided once again into pre, mid, and post. The pre-trib people believe that Christ is going to rapture the church before the tribulation. The mid-trib believe it's going to be at the halfway mark, and that seems to be a pretty popular one. And then there's those who believe he'll rapture the church away at the end of the 7 years of tribulation. And so that's defining those terms. All right, we've got about 5 minutes. I don't know if this has been helpful or not. It might have been boring. hopefully it was helpful in some ways to try to get some definitions out there. Let me ask, are there any, I got the one question, are there any other questions that you might have before we extend the invitation? About any terms? Good question. That's often the question that we have. And I don't think the Hadean realm, your belief on the Hadean realm, changes that either way. Because if you take the traditional belief, which says Hadean realm divided into paradise, a place of reward, Tartarus, or torments, a place of punishment, it's still the same question was asked. Why have a judgment? And seems to me that the best answer that we've given, that has been given, is number one, any reward or punishment before judgment is still not as great as reward and punishment after judgment. The Bible seems pretty clear on that. Number two, judgment serves not only for man, but also for the glory of God. Judgment is a time when every knee shall bow, every tongue shall confess that Christ is Lord. Judgment is a time when all the evil and wickedness that has been done will get an account for, and God will set everything straight. And so, in other words, I think we ask that question because we get focused on the human side of it. But I think if you look at it from the God perspective, judgment is about the sentencing, it's about the glory of God, and about God being just in His judgments. And ultimately, it's about the long-term perspective. All the world is moving toward that final end of this world where God sets everything right by His sovereignty, by His judgment. That's the best I can do with it. Another question. Any other questions? Well, we're going to be studying these things for the next couple months at different times, Sunday morning, Sunday night, some. And I certainly don't know all these things. That's why we're studying them. And a lot of these things we don't have answers for. Don't think that all the answers are going to be given. But I think there is benefit still in studying. And we also, some things don't need to be overly dogmatic about as the Hadean realm issue is. I think we can study them but give our opinion. But it's an issue still that we have to say that this is what I think about it, this is what I believe, but we don't have to be overly dogmatic and say someone who doesn't believe that is just wrong. Let's extend the Lord's invitation at this point. If you are here and you need to respond to the gospel, if you want to put Christ on in baptism, we give that opportunity as together we stand and sing.